Good morning, everyone. It's so nice to have you all here and see you. You look great from here. My last sitting was by video, so I didn't get to see who was sitting out there. Not one of you looks like a terrorist. All right. We want to thank and welcome Judge John Blakey of the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, who is sitting by designation because he's so smart. And I'll stop with the jokes. All right. Case number one. Appeal 15-16-13. William Charles Construction versus Teamsters Local Union 627. And it's Mr. Vincent, isn't it?
Good morning. May it please the court. Josh Vincent on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, William Charles Construction. This is an appeal from an order by the district court enforcing two arbitral awards. One concerns what we call a back pay grievance. The other concerns a seniority grievance. The district court held that William Charles did not timely challenge those arbitral awards within 90 days of their entry. And we've raised two primary issues in this appeal. The first one concerns both arbitral awards, and that is whether William Charles ever received any notice of a final entry of an award.
I know what I think is the answer to this question, but I'd like to hear you tell me a little more, although you already have in the briefs. But did William Charles waive the right to argue about arbitrability by attending the hearing before the joint grievance committee?
No, we did not, Your Honor. The record, I think, makes it very clear from the affidavit of James Kohlhorst, and in fact, even the district court's opinion recognizes that William Charles appeared at that hearing and objected to the joint grievance committee's authority to even hear the grievance. And that's all that's really required under this court's decision in Fansteel.
So what would have happened if William Charles just didn't appear?
That would have been an option, too. I mean, that is something else. They could have declined to appear. There was an objection that was made prior to the hearing in writing. But the key thing is, at least under Fansteel, they showed up, made the objection known, and then are allowed under Fansteel to go ahead and proceed under it. But in fact, in this case, Mr. Holstrom testified, or Kohlhorst, excuse me, testified by affidavit that they did not participate in the proceeding. In fact, he wasn't even allowed to participate in the proceeding. So he was there, he made the objection. That's all that's required in order to preserve it for purposes of challenging substantive arbitrability here.
And stayed through the entire time.
I'm not sure what you mean, Judge.
Well, he just stayed there.
Yes, he did.
And then left when everyone else left.
As far as we know, yes.
Okay.
But I think the point, if you want to go straight to the issue of substantive arbitrability, that only affects the one grievance, and that's the back pay grievance that we're talking about here. And on that particular issue, you know, the Supreme Court has made it very clear in the AT&T versus Communication Workers case, two important principles. And one is that you are only required to arbitrate those things that you agree by contract to arbitrate. And the second principle is that question of arbitrability is a threshold question for the court. It is not a question for an arbitrator. And there is a series of cases that have followed the logic of the AT&T decision, one in this district or in the circuit, the Rabin case from, I think, 1989, and then a series of cases that come out of the Second Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit that have all recognized that in these circumstances where the arbitration award was made by a committee that did not have authority under the party's contract to decide that issue, that the 90-day statute of limitations period doesn't apply because there is this threshold question that must be addressed first as to substantive arbitrability.
Why didn't your client challenge within 90 days?
Well, I think the answer to that is because we didn't really get any notice of a final award, which is really, I think, the issue that affects both grievances in this case. In this case, If you look at the arbitration awards at the union...
If you did have notice, would you have been bound by the 90 days to
no,
challenge?
No, not with respect to the grievance concerning the back pay award, because that one was not substantively arbitrable. The seniority grievance, we concede, that's one that did fall within the terms of the collective bargaining agreement and would have had the Joint Grievance Committee certainly would have had jurisdiction, so to speak, to hear that one. But as to the grievance with regard to the back pay, and that's almost like a situation of lack of personal jurisdiction. I mean, that's an award that's being entered by a body that has no authority whatsoever to even hear it.
Well, let's then, I guess, discuss what we should make of the case law from the Seventh Circuit that seems to say that the 90-day statute of limitation is a strict, no exceptions deadline, that you either have to challenge within 90 days or expect to pay up. Let's discuss that.
Well, that's what I think is particularly interesting and significant about this case, because this case sort of fits a part of the mosaic of that area of the law that this court has not really squarely addressed except in the Rabin decision from 1989, because in Rabin you had two different defendants. You had Rabin and Sons, and you had Rabin Brothers. And one had clearly signed the collective bargaining agreement. The other had clearly not signed it. And in the course of that decision, the court specifically found that the one who had signed it, they were stuck. They didn't challenge, neither had challenged it within 90 days. But the one who had signed the arbitration agreement, I'm sorry, the collective bargaining agreement, they were stuck. There was no question they had to challenge it within 90 days. There was no issue as to substantive arbitrability on that particular defendant. But with respect to the second defendant, which I believe was Rabin and Sons, they had never signed the collective bargaining agreement. They had never entered into an agreement to arbitrate disputes with the union. And the court found that they were free to challenge and could not have that award enforced against them, even though they had failed to challenge it within the 90-day period. And the point that I think is significant in that case, and that really is the thread that I think the court now needs to pull through to the current time, because Rabin was decided so long ago and there's been this intervening development of the law in the other circuits, is under these circumstances now, Rabin said there can be this collision of the policies that the AT&T case demonstrates, where you must look at the party's contract to determine did they agree to arbitrate this dispute, versus the rule that Your Honor just explained, that absolute 90-day rule and the desire for efficiency in these types of proceedings. And when those two collide, which is what we have in this case is the collision of the two policies. We're now at a point, and I think probably the most instructive decision maybe in this circuit, it's by a district court judge, it was Judge Eschbach, when he sat on the district court in Indiana, wrote a decision, the PPG decision, where he explained that you've got to take apart the parties' contracts and look and see exactly what it was they did or didn't agree to. And that case involved a very similar situation to this one, where you have two different contracts. One is specifically designed to govern the jurisdictional dispute that we have at issue in this case.
And that's the PLA, right?
That's the PLA. And that's the one that is exclusive. It says that if there's any conflict with a area collective bargaining agreement, like the one that the Teamsters are trying to enforce here, the PLA is primary. It trumps it. And that's the one that controls any type of jurisdictional dispute.
So this dispute that he didn't argue before, this is what they teamed under the Teamsters collective bargaining agreement. Is that right?
Well, the Teamsters collective bargaining agreement, they're trying to claim that there's the jurisdictional dispute over which union was entitled to the work.
Right.
All right. The PLA, that was, in fact, they acknowledged that that's the controlling agreement. They brought the grievance about the jurisdictional dispute under that document, and that's where it was decided.
Which, of course, William Charles signed.
Correct.
And paid into union wages and benefits.
Not exactly, Your Honor. We weren't paying anything to the Teamsters until after Arbitrator Zip decided the jurisdictional dispute and found that the work needed to be assigned to the Teamsters. And it was only at that point that William Charles signed a participation agreement with them.
Well, would that have then signified William Charles's intent to be bound by
as to
by the collective bargaining agreement?
Yes, except as to jurisdictional issues. Okay? Mm-hmm. And that's the whole point here.
Is there a meaningful distinction between the absence of any agreement and an agreement that's clearly in place, and then the question is whether or not the dispute falls within it?
I would
because
say...
Because the examples you're citing, there was no privity, there was no contract between the parties at all, and that's a different case when you agree from two parties that have agreement and there will be arbitration or collective bargaining as to some.
Yeah, and I would say to you that if I had to rewrite my brief, I probably would not have used so much the term about non-signatories to a collective bargaining agreement, because technically, yes, we are signatory to both agreements, the project labor agreement and the collective bargaining agreement. And that's why I think is the significance of this case and why it fits so closely with the AT&T decision, and that is because, and Judge Eschbach's decision from that PBG case, you have to look at the contracts and take apart the contracts to see what did the parties contractually agree to do. I mean, that's why ultimately I think this case, more than a labor law case, is a case about contract interpretation. Mm-hmm.
Well, initially, this jurisdictional dispute, I'll use the word engineers versus the Teamsters.
Yes.
And that is the internal one. And looking at Zip's opinion, it was a tough decision, actually, because William Charles had previous work a lot of times doing these truck drivers with the engineers.
That's correct, Judge.
And so it was a reasonably close decision, and once that happened, as I understand it, William Charles immediately took those drivers off, and then they goofed up, they messed up a seniority thing, admit that.
Yes.
And that's under the new
precisely, Judge.
Agreement. So what I'm concerned here with is, it just is, as Judge Blakey said, that, well, why did they let this go so long? And it's true, when you look at this thing that came from the Teamsters and they said the decision is going to be looked over and then confirmed, apparently it had already been done. Well, and that is on its face the problem. The problem I have, they said, well, gee, this is, you'd think you would get on it. But what thing that's left out of that, and that is the made whole issue. And somebody came up with $1.4 million.
Yes.
And that would be, I think Mr. Kohlhorst would have been in there the next hour if that had been included.
Well, that's probably
But that
true.
Was not included.
And well,
that,
and the other
that
thing
bothers
is
me because what the outcome is that William Charles is going to be paying twice for the same work.
Yes, from the
And
from
this is a dispute between two unions.
That is
And the who was unjustly problem. Enriched?
Yes.
I worry about that because if the engineers were unjustly enriched, are they going to pay that money to the Teamsters? I don't think so.
No.
And so I look at this as a problem.
Well, and I would say to you, Judge, that I think from the standpoint of what happened when that email comes through from Mr. Kaczynski to Mr. Kohlhorst, I mean, that would almost be like the clerk's office sending me an email saying, here's something that Judge Mannion has written. It's being circulated to Judges Rovner and Blakey for their review and approval. Is that a decision?
I hope you didn't see that.
That's not a decision. I mean, is the time now running for my petition for rehearing? Certainly not. And I think that's an important point for this case, too.
Such a great idea.
But I think that's an important point that from, again, a public policy standpoint, I think there needs to be, you know, some certainty as to when a final decision has been rendered and when notice of it has been given.
Well,
and at best, there's a fact question here over this. I mean, you could send it back for a trial on that issue because there are conflicts about that. But you know, the point that I think is most significant is when you look at the arbitral awards that are attached to the counterclaim for enforcement, there's no evidence that those were ever sent to us. Nothing. After the only evidence in the record is what we put in, which is Kohlhorst's affidavit, along with the email dated April 3rd, that doesn't even include the seniority grievance outcome. It only talks about the back pay grievance, doesn't talk about the seniority one, which was heard on the same day, and those are the two that they're trying to enforce. And so when you look at it, it's very incomplete. There's no way, I think, you could fairly say that we should have known at that point in time that a final decision had been rendered and the clock was running.
Well, the union...
And they waited. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Judge. Thanks. I apologize.
My third well, so I think I'm... Okay. The union claims that the calculation of the money award from the decision of the joint grievance committee would have been just a simple calculation based on days of work and hourly wage.
Well, there's no evidence of that. And second of all, you know, just from if you look at arbitrator Zipp's decision, I think there's a very good clue in that decision as to why it would not be a simple calculation, and that's because in his decision, arbitrator Zipp pointed out, in trying to make that tough call, who gets it, the Teamsters or the engineers, that in addition to driving the articulating end dump trucks, these people also have to operate scrapers, the big industrial pieces that scrape the pavement off the ground before it's put in the trucks and hauled away.
Who's that, the engineers?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so there's a question there about whether the Teamsters would even have the specialty personnel to operate both the articulating end dump trucks and the scrapers. And so from that standpoint, you might have completely different specialties involved in the performance of this work at different rates. I mean, we have no idea where that $1.4 million figure comes from. I don't think it's a simple calculation. There could be difference in benefit contributions. There could be differences in overtime on weekends that the two different unions have. I mean, there's a multitude of factors that could have affected it, but I think the biggest one is how would it be staffed, particularly because the operating engineers could operate both scrapers and the articulating end dump trucks. And there's no indication that the Teamsters would do that other than to drive the trucks.
Well, the other question, though, is it's we're talking about the engineers were already paid.
Yes.
For what they did in that period of time.
That's correct.
And now the Teamsters are going to have to be paid for the same work.
Yes, that there
would there also have to be some focus on mitigation if those 16 drivers actually got work elsewhere?
Well, I would think that it's a great point, Judge. Yes, I think there
would. And that worries me.
Yes.
Because I think this just doesn't work. That initial jurisdictional thing was confined to the two unions. And
yes.
William Charles sort of said, okay, you and him fight.
Yeah, that was right. That was not our battle.
And nothing was said in there other than making made whole.
Right.
About that $1.4 million, which I assume would be in excess of whatever money they hope to make on that project.
And I think from that standpoint, Judge, too, the public policy of adhering to what the PLA is supposed to accomplish is to avoid precisely this, that being trapped between, as I think the amicus brief put it, the devil in the deep blue, where you've got the two unions fighting with one another, and the risk that because you signed it to one union, you're going to be called upon to pay twice. And that's exactly what the PLA process was designed to prevent, because it doesn't provide for any award of back pay.
And so you're basically saying that money amount, whatever it is, should be confined to the jurisdictional decision one way or the other, as opposed to going on with whatever they call that committee,
the only place that that claim, that grievance could have been brought was under the PLA. It's all derived from the jurisdictional dispute. So I will save what's left of my time for rebuttal unless the court has another question.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Coming up, Mr. Eisenberg.
May it please the court, my name is Nathan Eisenberg. I represent the appellee Teamsters Local 627 in this case. I think at its essence, this case concerns whether a party to an arbitration proceeding can challenge a grievance award after the statute of limitations has run.
So is it your position that any dispute, including a jurisdictional dispute, could have gone straight to the joint grievance committee for arbitration?
Well, we disagree with the characterization of the grievance before the joint grievance committee as a jurisdictional issue.
How do you separate that from the award?
Well, the grievance itself cited five different provisions of the Articles of Construction Agreement that were being violated by not having Teamsters doing the work. The award itself also mentions another article, the referral provisions, so that where William Charles was not having the Teamsters doing the work, there is an independent contract violation under the Articles of Construction Agreement.
So I'm going to ask my question again because I'm not sure I got an answer that I can work from. Could any dispute, including a jurisdictional dispute, have gone straight to the Joint Grievance Committee for arbitration?
If it was a legitimate jurisdictional dispute where the issue is which union was entitled to be assigned the work, would have to go to the PLA.
Okay. Well, wait a minute. Is it a yes or a no? You know, I'm a simple person. A simpleton, some would say. No.
I wouldn't say that.
No,
a straight jurisdictional dispute, jurisdictional between unions, would need to go straight to the PLA committee.
So it would?
Yes.
Okay.
I think the problem with the question is I don't think that the grievance before the Joint Grievance Committee was a jurisdictional dispute.
And I just don't see how you separate that.
Yeah.
I can understand with the seniority issue, because that was clearly Wim Charles did hire those two guys, and they jumped ahead of the seniority, and they admit the problem and paid for that. And that was after the Zip's decision. As soon as they had Zip's decision, they immediately switched to the Teamsters and goofed up on a seniority issue. But everything about that made whole occurs before all the damage, or whatever you want to call it, occurs before Zip's decision. And I have a problem with the... it's not going to be the unions that are... the engineers got paid, and the Teamsters get paid after that, and I really have a problem with paying twice when I think that really is confined to the jurisdictional issue.
See, forgive me, but the PLA does indeed say that all signatories agree to be bound and abide by the current applicable area collective bargaining agreement for the relevant union. But it also does say that all jurisdictional disputes must be resolved pursuant to the PLA. It seems to me then that non-jurisdictional disputes get resolved under the collective bargaining agreement and jurisdictional ones get resolved under PLA. So why was it okay for this jurisdictional dispute to go to the Joint Grievance Committee at all?
Again, we do not view this as a jurisdictional dispute that went to the Joint Grievance Committee.
That's your story, and you're sticking to it.
Well, it happens to be accurate from our perspective, and I would raise a couple other issues. First of all, the Joint Grievance Committee was considering those issues. Those issues were submitted to the Joint Grievance Committee, and the Joint Grievance Committee made a decision that it was arbitrable, and they issued the award, and then that award was not challenged within the 90 days. So even if the Joint Grievance Committee was wrong, William Charles was still required to bring the challenge to court within the appropriate statute of limitations.
Yeah, but what was not challenged in 90 days was the $1.4 million, because that wasn't in it. It said something about being made whole.
But many, many arbitration awards find contract violations, find violations, and award a make-whole remedy. That's fairly typical in arbitration awards.
Well, maybe making whole isn't, you said something made whole, they were made whole, and I guess if it really got down to adding and subtracting, it would come down to, well, okay, those 16 workers, how do you make them whole? I guess that's who's going to be made whole, the ones that didn't get the driver's jobs.
Yeah, and I would concede that the factual record in the district court is a little sparse on this point.
A little bit,
and that's because none of
these... It's not mentioned.
That's because it wasn't raised at all. The argument that William Charles is raising about whether or not there's a final award about this make-whole, these weren't discussed at all in the district court. That's why the record is so sparse on those points.
There's your rebuttal. Okay, yeah.
What facts are in the record that this was the final decision that would trigger the 90 days?
There is a record that the cop, first of all, that William Charles was present at the hearing and it was decided at the hearing itself. Later on, it was reduced to writing and a copy of that decision.
Did the hearing determine the dollar amount?
No.
Okay.
Again, it was a make-whole remedy.
And I'm going to beat a dead truck again, I guess. How can this not be a jurisdictional dispute? I mean, didn't it claim redress for a dispute over which of two unions was entitled to the work of driving these particular types of trucks?
Well, again, there are other, when they used employees other than the Teamsters to perform the work, that would violate the Articles of Construction Agreement. And one of the ways, actually, that the appellees are really prejudiced by the lack of the record and the failure to raise these issues in the district court is, had these issues been raised, we would have pointed out under a prior project labor agreement, the one immediately before this, there was specific language that talked about you can't have back wages.
But that's not in the record.
No, because right. These issues weren't raised in the district court.
Well, tell me this. Are you arguing that the initial decision by Zip under the PLA was not valid?
No.
Wasn't the grievance for back pay and benefits part of the very grievance that Zip had ruled on under the...
No, there was a separate grievance that was filed with the Joint Grievance Committee alleging violations of the Articles of Construction Agreement. And that's the grievance that was heard by the Joint Grievance Committee and which was decided. And I wanted to get back to the point about the notice, because there's one thing that the district court pointed out which is really useful, which is not only was a copy of the decision sent to William Charles after it was issued, but approximately 3 weeks later, William Charles actually responded and again contested the award. So not only did they get notice in the form of a copy of the decision, but then they actually responded, I want to say April 24th of 2014. So they had notice, they responded, and yet they still failed to challenge it within the appropriate statute of limitations.
Look, the decision that was attached to that April email, April 3rd, I guess, contained no monetary award. How could that be a final decision declaring that William Charles owes $1.4 million in back pay and benefits if it makes no reference whatsoever to the amount owed?
Well, again, a make-whole remedy in arbitration is fairly standard, and that would be calculated simply by going back and looking at the employees that performed the work and the hours that they worked and applying the contractual wage rate. That's a very ministerial calculation.
But there's a dispute whether or not that is, in fact, just a calculation. There's a dispute about whether or not that's an important part of making a decision final, and any notice that would trigger 90 days would actually have to be something that was final.
Well, but the dispute about whether or not it's ministerial or not, there's no factual record on that because it wasn't raised in the district court.
Look,
so the argument about which operators would do it or whether or not there would be a problem doing this, there's no factual record to base those assertions on because there's no records that were submitted to the district court on those points.
Didn't Cole Horse declare from the beginning of the suit in the district court that he never received a final copy of the Joint Grievance Committee decision?
There's a statement to that effect. I think that, as I said, the district court pointed out to the fact that Mr. Kohlhorst was at the committee when they rendered a decision.
But wouldn't that be sufficient to preserve a claim about the date that the 90-day statute of limitations begins to run?
No, I mean, it was, again, undisputed that he received the email containing the decision, and it's also undisputed that after the fact, they responded in such a way that they had received notice of the decision and were contesting the decision.
But he declared that he never received a final copy.
But the decision he received was the final copy. I understand.
It says in the decision that it was subject to the approval.
Right.
And he didn't know that approval had already been made. Why would it say that?
I don't know why it says that.
Well, it says, quote, still subject to the review and approval by the contractor members of the JGC. What kind of a final decision is still subject to review by the people involved.
There is none. And that's why I think that statement is really being read way out of context, and again, without any evidentiary support that there was further review that could be had.
Boy, that's some statement.
Well, the procedure on how the Joint Grievance Committee operates, contained in the Articles of Construction Agreement, contains no provision that would allow the management members of the committee later on to change their mind. So really what you have is a statement by somebody who was disseminating the award, making that statement out of context and inconsistent with the terms of the Articles of Construction Agreement itself.
What you're telling me, somebody who made that statement, are you referring to the one who wrote and sent that out? I noticed they didn't change it a bit. It even has a typo in it. It's the same one that's
right
that he got. But
my understanding is there was a administrative person at the AGC who sent a copy of the award. And it's that email that you're referring to. It's not a statement by anybody that was on the committee. And it's, as I say, it's a misstatement or it's a statement that's way out of context. And the fact that that
but we have to deal with it. A misstatement, out of context, we have to deal with it now.
Right, but that's an issue, again, that wasn't raised before the district court at all.
Counsel, aren't you asserting the procedural bar? Wouldn't you have to show that notice was given?
I think we have shown that notice was given. Well, we have shown that the
notice was given in the form of a final judgment. You keep saying it wasn't raised in the district court, but you're the one who's saying now that 90 days is too long to wait to challenge the issue of whether or not a back pay award flows from the jurisdictional dispute.
Yes, but what we have shown is that the company was at the hearing itself where the decision was made. When there was a written copy, they
were
sent
stop right there. The company was there. They visited. They came and said, we object. They're visitors. They're telling you we're not going to be part of this.
Well,
but we're here, you know.
I think there that you have to unpack the issue about what happened at the Joint Grievance Committee hearing. Because if a party shows up at a arbitration proceeding, and it's a Joint Grievance Committee proceeding, but that's treated as the same as an arbitration proceeding.
Well, you know, in the brief, maybe you can help me with this. You stated that William Charles waived its objection to arbitrability before the committee. But you also concede that raised a complaint before that committee that the dispute was probably heard under the PLA and not the collective bargaining agreement. So right there we've got an argument about arbitrability.
Well, that's the point I wanted to point out, is that if you raise the issue and then you allow the Joint Grievance Committee to decide that issue,
what do you mean by allow?
Well,
should
William Charles
disrupt the meeting?
No, William Charles arrived at the Joint Grievance Committee. They said, we think there's this issue about whether or not the PLA or the Articles of the Construction Agreement apply, and then they had the Joint Grievance Committee issue a decision. So once you allow the Joint Grievance Committee to make that decision, you're waiving your objection. What Fansteel and Jones Dairy Farm talk about, that if you're going to preserve your right to challenge substantive arbitrability, it has to be clear and explicit. And they didn't do that.
Could be clearer or more explicit than, you know, we're here visiting?
Well, parties in arbitration all the time ask the arbitrator or the Joint Grievance Committee to interpret the agreements that are at issue. And so when they arrived and they did that, they argued the merits of the case to the Joint Grievance Committee. What they didn't do is they say, we object, we think that the committee lacks jurisdiction to hear this dispute in the first place, and we reserve our right later to challenge it. And they didn't do that.
Exactly what is your view of what they did do? They visited.
It's not that they visited. Is they came and they talked about the impact of these two agreements and they argued the merits. That's a contract interpretation issue. William Charles' reply brief starts with the idea that this is a contract interpretation issue, and what grievance and arbitration panels do is interpret contracts. And that's what happened here.
Well, when they argued the merits, didn't they argue that this was the wrong forum? Didn't they objected?
But then they let the Joint Grievance Committee make the decision on whether or not...
Well, they can't stop them from talking. I mean, what are they supposed to do? Turn the lights off?
Well, no. You make the clear and the explicit objection that they talk about in Jones Dairy and Fansteel that we're reserving the right, if this doesn't go our way, later on to bring a judicial challenge.
Well, see... So those would have been the magic words.
I'm not sure if there's any precise magic words, but they would have needed to say that we're not just letting you interpret these agreements, but we're preserving our right to raise this later in the appropriate forum. And again, they would also need to bring that challenge in the appropriate forum within the statute of limitations, which they did not do.
If they got notice.
Which we think they did.
Yeah.
And on that day, on the night, on the day of the hearing, they were aware. And they were aware that the timing was running. And I think that's where you look at cases like Rabin, you look at cases like Sullivan versus Gilchrist, which William Charles really doesn't address, where if you have noticed that the proceeding is moving forward and you fail to bring the challenge within 90 days, you've really... waived your ability to raise that in court.
Yeah, but Rabin, though they split that one in half and said half of them signed the agreement.
Right, but
that was the big mistake. They didn't read it, or hindsight said they shouldn't have done that.
The operative fact in Rabin is there are two parties, and the union only brought the grievance against one of those parties, Rabin Brothers. Rabin and Sons was not a party to the arbitration proceeding at all. And because it wasn't a party to the arbitration proceeding, Rabin and Sons was allowed out. But Rabin Brothers wasn't. The grievance was against Rabin Brothers, and therefore the challenge that they were making that they weren't signatory when they didn't bring it within the appropriate statute of limitations was waived, and judgment was found against them. So we really think... the statute of limitations issue and the failure to bring these issues is really dispositive of the case. And again, I want to emphasize this point one more time, which is the issue of substantive arbitrability was never briefed. It was never raised in the district court at all. If you look at the district court briefing, the only issue that was raised and that was briefed was the statute of limitations issue and what was the appropriate statute of limitations. And that's why the record and the district court decision are all focused on the statute of limitations issue and not substantive arbitrability, because it wasn't part of the complaint, it wasn't part of the pleadings. There's nothing in the briefing on it. That's why the district court decision only addresses the statute of limitations, because that is the only issue that was before the district court in the first place. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Vinson.
Just a couple of quick points. First, I think it's remarkable that counsel would say that the fellow, Mr. Kaczynski, who sent the email with the supposed award, had no authority to say what he said in the email, and yet that was supposed to start the clock. How can you reconcile that argument that this guy put something in an email to us that he had no authority to say, but yet that communication was sufficient to start the 90-day clock? I mean, that is a completely inconsistent argument. So I think right there that's a concession that whatever was communicated, if the man didn't have authority to send it, could not have been notice of a decision. I mean, that's, a pretty big admission. I think with respect to this, the last argument about substantive arbitrability not having been preserved below, just look at pages 20 to 22 of our response to their summary judgment motion. It's right there. That's where we discussed the Rabin case, the point we were just talking about. That's where we discussed the Sullivan versus Gilchrist case. We clearly argued that under these circumstances, because there was no agreement to arbitrate jurisdictional disputes under the CBA, that was the point of that whole argument. It's there. It's at pages 20 to 22. I agree the district court did not address that. I think that was error not to have resolved that question, but the argument is there. The question, you know, the counsel was resisting the characterization of the grievance that they're trying to enforce here as being a jurisdictional dispute. There's just no way. I mean, to me, that almost matches up perffectly with what this court was asked to do on remand from the Supreme Court in the AT&T case, was look at the agreements and decide, you know, what's arbitrable and what's not. What was the nature of the agreement here? They recognized that the whole question of the supposed misassignment of the work was a jurisdictional dispute because they initiated it under the PLA. So they recognized by bringing the first grievance in front of the PLA that the jurisdictional dispute was properly controlled by the PLA. The back pay grievance that they later filed under the CBA references Judge Zipp's decision. It's all derived from the jurisdictional dispute. It couldn't be based on anything else. It can't be based on the CBA. He's citing Article 5, Section 2 of the CBA about assignment of work. That is superseded by the PLA, Paragraph 1.5, I believe it is, which says that assignments of work and disagreements about assignments of work are governed by the PLA. So there's a conflict. I mean, he can cite Article 5, Section 2 of the CBA all he wants, but he signed the PLA, which said it trumps the CBA. And Article 1.5 of the PLA says that that controls jurisdictional disputes. The question about the make-whole relief, you know, certainly the Joint Grievance Committee had the power to try and do that. Their CBA does have a provision in it that says they can make these calculations, and they didn't.
Where did they come up with that?
That $1.4 million? Yeah. We have no idea. We just get a call from a lawyer. Ironically, 14 days after the 90-day period from April 3rd has passed, oh, you owe us $1.4 million. Comes out of thin air. You know, there's a gross, as Your Honor has pointed out, there is a gross inequity in this case. It's, I think, an example of overreaching. Yeah, they won the jurisdictional dispute. It's interesting that they waited until September of 2013 to even raise the jurisdictional dispute. The work dates back to May of 2013, so they waited 4 months before they even complained about the supposed misassignment. And now they're asking for all the money back so that we have to pay twice. Gross inequity in this case, and we would ask you to reverse it and remedy it. Unless the court
has
questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks, both of you. Really terrific briefs from both sides. Tricky little case, isn't it? All right. It'll be taken under advisement.